am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Since we are talking about the topic of jurisprudential status of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei, let me ask you this question. What are the things that make the prayers void, Sheikh Javid?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are a number of things that make the prayer void. At least there are 12 invalidating agents. And of course, it will take us some time to discuss all of them. But I would like to be very quick in giving a short account of those invalidating agents.
I appreciate it.
Now, to begin with, if any of the prerequisites of prayers cease to exist while one is offering prayer, of course, if a person comes to know that the dress with which he has covered himself is usurped one, now this will make his prayer void, or the place where he offers his prayer is a usurped place, then he cannot continue with his prayers because his prayers is void. So this is one of the invalidating agents, mm-hmm. because one of the prerequisites of prayer is violated in this case. Now, the second invalidating agent is, as mentioned in the Risala, is that if a person intentionally or by mistake or uncontrollably commits an act which makes his wuzu or ghusl void, like, for example, when a person urinates or when urine comes out, because sometimes a person deliberately urinates mm-hmm. or urine comes out without him being in control of the urine.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, obviously, he cannot pray. He should, renew his wuzu and repeat the prayer, because the prayer becomes void once the urine comes out. And of course, we have discussed in one of the previous episodes that if a person is incontinent, he is not able to control his urine, or is mm-hmm. not able to control his bowel, and or he discharges something impure, or he passes wind every now and then without him being in control of the mm-hmm. his belly, then in that case there are special rules which must be followed by that person who is suffering from a kind of abnormality or a kind of disorder. So such people who are incontinent, of course, as we yes. discussed in one of the previous episodes, should follow specific rules regarding mm-hmm. Regarding incontinence. So that is the second thing.
Yes.
If a person deliberately urinates or discharges something impure, then his prayer becomes void.
What's the third invalidating agent?
The third one, of course, if a person folds his hand, mm-hmm. Just as, as Sunnis do, like folding his hand is not permissible in Islam according to the Shi'i school of faith.
Yes.
Yeah. It is forbidden, because we believe that it was the second caliph who innovated this practice. It was not practiced by the Prophet of Islam, and no one was folding their hands mm-hmm. in the time of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, whether those who lived in Makkah and those who lived in Medina, of course, no one. But it was started during the second caliph. Therefore, folding hand is absolutely forbidden. And if a person folds his hand, if he is not in the state of taqiyah, or if he is not practicing quietism or dissimulation or something like that, he cannot fold his hand. And if he folds his hand, of course, his prayer becomes void.
Sometimes people touch each other's hands. Like, for example, your right hand touches the left hand, all right? Mm-hmm. Does that count as a folding hand,
It doesn't, folding is...
Like, for example, if it is itchy and you want to scratch it.
Yeah, it doesn't affect the prayer, because you're scratching your hand
mm-hmm.
and you are actually in common view seen as someone scratching his hand
mm-hmm.
and not folding his hand, because you fold your hand out of humility,
Mm-hmm.
You are, folding hand is a mark of humility and mm-hmm. a mark of reverence.
Yes.
And of course, if you do this, to show that you are actually, you are being more, more submissive,
yes.
or you're showing more humbleness, more humility, then that is forbidden.
Okay.
Otherwise, simply touching your hand or scratching your hand does not make your prayer void.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is the third one.
Yes, thank you very much, Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javed, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our dear guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before the break, Sheikh Javed, you gave us three invalidating agents of the prayer.
Yeah.
What is the fourth one?
The fourth thing which invalidates prayers is to say Amin, Amin. And this is a practice common among Sunni Muslims when they recite, for example, when the Hamd is, Surah Al-Hamd is recited, then all the people standing behind the prayer leader says Amin. Of course, our religious authorities have forbidden saying Amin in the prayer. If a person deliberately and consciously says Amin after Surah Al-Hamd, now his prayer becomes void. Mm-hmm. Of course, this rule, when applied to one praying individually, is based on ihtiyat. You know, the religious authority has said that if a person offering prayer says Amin, then as a measure of precaution, his prayer becomes void.
Mm-hmm.
As a measure of precaution. And the religious authorities are unanimous about this word being forbidden in the prayer. So no one from the religious authorities have ever said that you can still say Amin when you are saying, when you are offering individual prayer or when you are offering your prayers in a congregation. So that's forbidden.
Okay.
The fifth thing which invalidates prayers is to turn away from Qibla. You know, you are supposed to be facing and to be standing towards the Qibla, and you cannot deviate from the Qibla deliberately, intentionally. And of course, but okay, if you forgetfully stand, in a direction which is not facing Qibla,
mm-hmm.
you are partially deviate from the Qibla, but you are not doing it deliberately, there's no problem. But deviation from the Qibla, according to all religious authorities, it makes the prayer void, and one should not do it deliberately or intentionally. Now, there is the sixth invalidating agent which invalidates prayer, of course, and that is to talk, even by uttering a single word consisting of one or single letter which has a meaning, and of course, and which denotes something.
Mm-hmm.
So talking makes the prayer void. One, you cannot talk. But obviously you are praying, you are talking to Allah, but you cannot, while talking to Allah, you cannot talk to someone else, or you
mm-hmm.
cannot utter a word. So if you, for example, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, if you say, for example, Qe, which was one letter. And of course, in Arabic, the word Qe means to protect yourself. Protect it. It's one letter, but it means protect yourself. It's a kind of talking to someone. So this will make your prayer white.
But what about pointing to something without uttering any words?
There is no problem if you want to point to someone. You know, it has been reported that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, while praying, killed a snake. You know, killed a snake.
Wow.
So it means that, you know, pointing is not a big deal. You know, you can do it to make someone understand.
Because we have body language, you know.
Body language,
and
of course.
If you point to someone, for example, referring to do something in the room, that would be like, again, talking to that person and conveying a message without utterance.
Without utterance, of course.
So doesn't it make the prayer void?
It doesn't make it. So, because if you want to make a gesture, for example, telling someone who is sitting in front mm-hmm. of you to, for example, turn off the stove or turn off the light or on or do something or close the window, there's no problem. As long as you are not moving vigorously and your body is not shaking vigorously, there's no problem.
Okay.
But while moving your hand or your body Of course, you are not allowed to say or recite any word or any zikr.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Shawit, for all your nice contribution and answers to questions. So we have talked about six of those 12 invalidating inches, and then we're going to continue that in the upcoming session and episode. Thank you for listening to this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa Al-Bahadali and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program we discuss problems and other issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers provided in this program are based upon the Holy Quran and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all, supplemented by scientific data and facts. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend and Islamic researcher, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi from the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Today, dear listeners, we will be discussing mistake number 14 of 28 mistakes parents make when raising their children. Mistake number 14 is parents who make too many promises to their children. Dear Sayyid, now why is this a mistake?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. We see that some parents, when it comes to encouraging their children to do an action or to do an act, they want to give an incentive to get the child to do this action. So they promise the child, if you pray, for example, I will give you this.
Right.
If you study, I will give you that. If you do this, you do that. So in a way, we trying to teach the child that he can only do these things under the fact that we can promise. Now, I think previously we did speak about the fact that we can give incentives after an action has been done.
Right.
So sometimes with parents, it's okay to promise them. But first you need to keep in mind that you should not promise a child or try to give a child anything on something that is obligatory on him. That's something that's wajib on him. For example, like praying or like doing his work or doing things that are important. He will understand that as a concept of bribery. You're trying to bribe him. I will
right.
do this for you if you pray. Okay, so this is kind of a bribe, in its nature. So this is what the child actually gets to learn.
When it comes to worshiping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
It does. So we see that sometimes even children, they themselves deliberately, if that's how they get raised, that they do certain actions and certain acts and certain movements, and sometimes they deliberately try to make or annoy their parents just so they could promise them something. So the child, for example, jumping around and being a monkey,
right.
and his mother trying to shut him up or to get him to become quiet, she says, then please sit down and I'll give you the chocolate. Sit down and we'll give you this. And
right.
especially now we see kids, for example, they do these things deliberately so their parents could give them the iPad or
the phone.
Phone
or something.
Like, there you go. Have the
right.
phone, just sit under. So they're deliberately doing that. And
right.
so what we have taught our children is the fact that for any action that we want them to do, they can get away with it if having the fact that we promise them something.
All right, and with that, let's go ahead and take a break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the mistakes some parents make when raising their children, and that being making too many promises. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
We get to say that we don't want to turn our children into materialistic people who
right.
just want to benefit from others. Because the more we give them, the more we promise them, is the more we turn them into materialistic beings. We're not turning
right.
them into a giving beings, but rather than hoarders and those who want to take and consume.
So they become very selfish in reality.
Yeah, exactly. So we create a lot of problems in this regard.
Right. And not only for the family and for the child, and also for society as a
exactly,
whole.
Exactly, because we're creating a ticking bomb for society. This
yeah.
is what we're doing. What we also sometimes do when it comes to giving the children too much promises, we give so much promises to the extent that it goes beyond giving a promise. And parents, this is a problem because parents, they use that method in trying to get the child either to be quiet, to do something.
Right.
Now, the problem with this is that a lot of parents, they make too much promises that they cannot keep, which turns into a lie, which is first we are teaching the child to lie. You can promise
right.
something but never do it, which obviously is lying. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi, he has a hadith, he says, never do not promise your children anything without giving it to them because they look at you as the Lord,
right.
as you are their God, right?
Yeah.
You are the highest authority in their life. If they see that you are breaking your promises, it will make it naturally for them to break any of their own promises,
yeah.
or at least will teach them to lie.
Naturally.
So as parents, don't promise your children anything that you are not sure whether you're going to do or not. Only promise them if you're 100% sure, you will fulfill this promise.
Right.
And what happens with parents is the more promises they give, even to themselves, it becomes, you know, natural thing. Oh, it's okay, I promise you this, I promise you that, I promise you this, I promise you that. And they keep throwing promises that they don't even know what their promises anymore.
Becomes an easy lie.
Exactly. It becomes just a method, a sedation method to control their children. But they don't understand the devastating effects that's going to have on the child himself. The child first will lose trust in his parents. That's the first thing he will have.
An extension in all authority figures.
Exactly. So he says, if my parents are lying, and they, why should I trust them? If he doesn't, if he does not trust his own parents, how is he going to trust me and you who are total strangers to him? So we're going to have trust issues.
Right.
We're going to tell him lies. We're going to even create a sense of sadness and break his heart when it comes to the fact that I promised him a bike, for example, or promised him a PlayStation, or promised him
something. And children remember that, broken promises.
Exactly, especially if you promise him something that he is looking forward to.
Right.
And comes time to it, and it's not there. So I can imagine that most of us, we have been through a lot of promises that parents broke with us.
Yep.
And I could mention a few in my head, on top of my head, just thinking about this topic.
Right.
So we've all been through this stage, which is a problem. Like I said, right now, it kept this gap between us and our parents. They promised, they broke their promises. And now we're wondering, like, you know, what were they thinking? So it causes problems to the child as the age he is and as he grow old. So when it comes to promises, take it easy. Make one promise a year and don't go overboard, because it will be israf and that is haram.
Right. And with that in mind, let's go ahead and take a quick break. Ya muqdiy al-khayrat,
ya muqdiy al-khayrat. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the harmful effects of promising our children too many things. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
And especially when we look at mothers, because the mothers are the ones who deal with children on a daily basis, and, you know, if not 24 hours,
they have more interactions. Right.
They have more interaction with the children. So they, throughout the day, they get tired, obviously trying to cook, clean, do this and do that. You know, they constantly, our mothers, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have mercy on them, they're always constantly doing things.
Right.
So their patience is a lot less. During the day, they're more tired, more frustrated. And when, especially when you have two or three monkeys running around the house, it doesn't make the job easier.
Of course
and
not.
And kids, obviously, in their nature, they're not mature enough to understand the mother and her position and how much pain they're causing her, or how much pain she's already going through. They don't understand that, especially when a woman is in her on her special time of the month. It makes things extremely sensitive for her.
It's like a hard mode for a whole week.
Yeah.
So, or super hard mode, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's the toughest time of her time.
Right.
Of her life. So with kids like this, the mothers, they find themselves forced in a way or another to deal with the children based on promises. And they keep throwing promises right, left, and center.
Right.
And they think, oh, it's okay, you know, I can promise him and never do it, just to keep him quiet. At the end of the day, it's his father that does the thing, not me. And to see that the kids later on, they, when they come to their mothers for their promises, they will find that they're not there anymore. The mother just was trying to keep them quiet.
They're completely forgotten sometimes.
Yeah. So what happens to the child is, that he's just like, okay, so next time his mother promises, he will never listen.
Yeah.
He will never consider it. He will just keep doing whatever he's doing. He's like, I've heard this many times. And if the mother wants to argue with him, she says, no, 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 I promise that this time I'm going to do it.
Just the basic,
promise upon promise, and the child would not buy it.
Of course.
He hasn't seen anything.
Just like threatening. We said this is one of the reasons why you shouldn't threaten your children.
Exactly, exactly. So it works in that opposite effect. So as mothers, for example, we have to be very careful when it comes to giving promises to our children. If you want to promise something that is tangible, that's something that is doable,
realistic.
Something that you can do either like at the moment or shortly after.
Right.
Don't promise them things that you won't do, or things you won't remember, or things that you just want to pass time with. Because
right.
children are very sensitive, and children, they never forget. They keep it in their heads. Now, I and you have grown older. We've forgotten a lot of the things that our parents promised us, unless something was very special to us back in the day.
Something that hurt a lot emotionally.
Yeah, yeah, something that left a trauma in your mind.
Right.
That your dad or your mother promised and they never gave it to you. Obviously, these ones you will remember, but the rest we don't remember. So it is very important that you don't make too much and too big promises, because children will never forget. They'll keep it in their mind. So this is a very common mistake that a lot of people do, a lot of parents do, around the day, around the clock,
right.
just to keep their kids under control. Now, there are other ways, there are better ways, there are more smarter ways to control
right.
a child and to get a child to do what you want to do without the need of trying to make too much and so much promises.
Yeah, Sayyid, I unfortunately have to interrupt you because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any suggestions, feedback, or some comments, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. Alternatively, you can also visit our website, parstoday.com. If you are much more modern and not so much old school, you can also find us on various social media websites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah in the illegally occupied Al-Quds, with a special focus on the British and American groups channeling huge sums of money to the settlers in the Palestinian capital. As always, we'll be joined by expert guests to delve into the background of Israel's ethnic cleansing and explore what can be done to stop it. But first, Bianca Rahimi gets us started with this special report.
The world saw the hypocrisy of Zionism, shorn of its pretensions, when the besieged Palestinian residents of Sheikh Jarrah turned their cameras on New Yorker settler Jacob Fushi as he uttered these infamous words.
You are stealing my house!
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it.
Today, Sheikh Jarrah still stands in the crosshairs of Zionist settler mass theft, with the Al-Salahiyya family sadistically removed in the dead of night and their house bulldozed to the ground. Sheikh Jarrah is a microcosm for the rest of Palestine, and the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population continues. However, Sheikh Jarrah is closer to us than we think. Those who fund the continuous Nakba there are among us. From Roman Abramovich, billionaire owner of Chelsea Football Club, and Jan Koum, founder of WhatsApp and former board member of Facebook, both funding settler group David, to media mogul Rupert Murdoch, funding the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds for settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. There are some well-known figures involved in these crimes against the Palestinians. But you may be surprised to know that the most prominent Islamophobic figures in both the UK and the US are funded by the same people that fund the settlers in Sheikh Jarrah. The Klarman Family Foundation, based in Boston, USA, has pumped millions into the David settler group cleansing Sheikh Jarrah. In addition to that, it has funded the Center for Security Policy, which gave us former US President Donald Trump's Muslim ban. The foundation has also pumped money into the Middle East Forum, which funded Tommy Robinson, who describes Muslims in the UK as enemy combatants. Another is the New York-based Hertog Foundation, led by Roger Hertog. His foundation has financed not only the David settlers of Sheikh Jarrah, but also the Henry Jackson Society, relentless pusher of Islamophobic policy against Muslims in the UK, the Center for Security Policy, and the David Horowitz Center, which has employed Tommy Robinson, Katie Hopkins, and Ben Shapiro. The New Jersey-based Russell Berry Foundation, led by former managing director at BlackRock and David Rosenblatt, has funded David alongside a U.S. group named the Investigative Project of Terrorism. This group was found to be infiltrating and spying on Muslim civil rights organization CARE in the U.S. The founder of the organization, Steve Emerson, is responsible for creating the myth of there being Muslim-only zones in the UK. The US-based Abstraction Fund also pumps money into David. It's run by Nina Rosenwald, the heir to the Vicks VapoRub fortune. She is best known for directing massive sums to Islamophobic groups. These include the Henry Jackson Society in the UK and the Middle East Forum. So, the same money being pumped into Sheikh Jarrah to dispossess the Palestinians there is also being pumped into a city near you to demonize, surveil, legislate against, and even attack Muslims on the streets. We can now reveal that there is a local branch of the main settler group in Sheikh Jarrah based in London by the name of UK Friends of the City of David. The directors of this UK-based operation are the very same figures from its US and Al-Quds-based counterparts. Rabbi Yehuda Mali founded and is the co-president of the Al-Quds-based settler organization. He is a director of the UK branch and also a board member of the US branch. He is also employed by the Israeli Ministry of Education as a strategic advisor. He founded the Hasbin settlement in the illegally occupied Golan Heights of Syria. Another founder of the settler group, also on the UK board, is David Be'iri. He served as deputy commander of the Duvdevan elite Israeli military unit, known for clandestine operations in the West Bank, in which they disguised themselves as Palestinians. In October 2010, he was caught on video deliberately ramming two Palestinian miners with his car and driving away. 7 years later, the Israeli regime controversially awarded him the Israel Prize for Lifetime Achievement. An additional director of the organization is Doron Spielman. He is a vice president of the Israeli settler group and currently works as spokesman for the Israeli military. The only London-based director of the UK charity is Daniel Peters, a partner with the global investment practice at Aon Hewitt. He seems to be the only one permanently based in the UK. Perhaps we should pay him a visit. The David UK branch has received funding from the Erinda Rothschild Foundation, which has also been a key donor to the Sheikh Jarrah Settlement Building Jerusalem Foundation, as well as to organizations known to be Islamophobic, like the Henry Jackson Society and the disgraced and now defunct Quilliam Foundation. Joyce Anley, a conservative foreign office minister, described this organization as carrying out radical settler activities under the guise of tourism. She questioned Israel's closeness to such a group, but now the question must be why the UK Charity Commission allows a group with a stated objective of demographic change in an occupied territory to operate on UK soil. The fact remains that those who fund the existential war against the Palestinians of Sheikh Jarrah are also funding a war against Muslims worldwide.
To discuss the ethnic cleansing of Sheikh Jarrah and the forces behind it, we're joined today by two expert guests. Asa Wynne-Stanley is an investigative journalist who writes for the award-winning Palestinian news website, The Electronic Intifada, and also has a weekly column for the Middle East Monitor. He's joined by our esteemed program expert, David Miller, who is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and co-founder of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. And now I'm going to go straight to you, David, and get your expert opinion on this, because I know that you've researched extensively into the UK Friends of the City of David and its US equivalent. Perhaps you could just tell us how true is it and how much of money from the West is going into supporting ethnic cleansing in occupied Palestine. And also perhaps you could update us on any other groups that may be active in the UK doing similar type of work.
Well, in relation to the Friends of David, I mean, there are literally millions of dollars going in to Sheikh Jarrah and in other places from this organisation, especially from the US Foundation. I mean, you saw some of the people involved there in the film. One of them, the guy from WhatsApp, gave $3 million to the foundation. Now, in the UK, they haven't managed so far to raise so much money. It's in the scores of thousands so far. But they have had some significant donors. They ran the Rothschild Foundation, is the Rothschild family main charitable foundation in this country, and they have put money into, effectively, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And that, as we saw in the film, they also give money to other organisations. It was mentioned a couple of times there, the Jerusalem Foundation, an organisation which is dedicated to Judaizing East Jerusalem and just forcing Palestinians out. There are many other organisations in my research. I haven't got time to list them all, because there are literally hundreds of other organisations who are raising money for specific settlements to fund the IDF and its brutal tactics in the West Bank and Gaza. And these are all organisations, by and large, which have a charitable status in the UK. So that this is a very wide-scale problem, but it's not really been dealt with in public debate so far.
That is interesting, especially given the fact, Asa, that, you know, depending on where someone wanted to put their money in support of, let's say, the Palestinians, you could get in a lot of trouble there. That's probably a topic for another episode. But I want to ask you about the earlier on in that report by Bianca, the gentleman from New York who suddenly showed up in a home which used to belong to a Palestinian family. They confronted him and so on. I'm sure you remember it went absolutely viral at the time. Perhaps you could just remind us about how this type of thing is happening. A guy from New York, an American citizen, ending up in a Palestinian person's home. Is he even spending any money himself? Or is it something which is being funded externally, that type of thing?
Yeah, he's probably not really spending much money himself. The Israeli settlers all over the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, are funded and subsidized extensively by the State of Israel and by these foreign foundations, charity. You know, these groups often have charitable status, really, in our countries, in the UK and the US and all over the Western world, really. And so, yeah, I think it's important to remember that's been happening in Sheikh Jarrah and other neighbourhoods of East Jerusalem is really common all over the West Bank. This is exactly what is happening day in and day out to the Palestinians. Palestinians are being driven off their land. They're being driven from their homes and then replaced with mostly European Jewish settlers who have come to take over their homes, be guided by this ideological vision, this racist settler colonial vision. And, you know, it's implemented. We're seeing it. These are just common everyday scenes from Palestine. People's homes are being demolished on the pretext of not having permits. And I say a pretext because almost invariably those permits are never given to Palestinians precisely and solely because they are not Jewish, because Israel defines itself as a Jewish state. It's a state only for Jews with a tolerated minority of so-called Arab Israelis, even though most Palestinians within the state of Israel identify themselves as Palestinians. So, yeah, this is not an abstract thing of, oh, settlements are bad. This is people's daily lives. People have been driven out of their homes because their only crime, quote-unquote, is that they're not Jewish.
And that is obviously a shocking fact,
yeah,
that we're dealing with here.
Yeah, but and money from this country and money from America, money from France, money from all over the Western world especially, is going into these organisations and being subsidised effectively by British taxpayers, because these organisations, these extreme Zionist settler organisations, have charitable status quite often in the UK and the US.
That brings me on to my next question, actually, because, again, Bianca's report exposed the fact that a lot of money goes into Islamophobic groups as well. So there seems to be this partnership, if you like, between Zionist organizations, which are trying to push the settler expansion program in occupied Palestine. But then there are all these groups that are being funded as well, which basically go after the religion of Islam and Muslims as well.
Yeah.
And so on. So perhaps, again, you could just tell us what you know about this money going into groups like maybe the Henry Jackson Society, for example, that are known for going after Muslims and Muslim beliefs.
Well, David's research, really, David has done more than anyone, really, I think, to expose this kind of, tight connection between the Zionist movement, between the Israel lobby on one hand, and between what's been termed the Islamophobia industry, or the counter-jihad movement. And David has done extensive academic work on this over the years, that's really important to look at. There is this real merging of interests, because the far right in Europe, in Western Europe, has for many years, and especially since 9/11, made Muslims, the Muslim population of Europe, their number one enemy. They made the Muslims the scapegoat in a very similar way to Jews in Nazi Germany and in Eastern Europe prior to the Holocaust were made the scapegoat of European racism, of European far-right racism, and even, not necessarily extremists, but the actual states, the British state before Hitler was extremely anti-Semitic, and so in a similar way now, the British state has these very close ties to the Islamophobia industry and is also making Muslims the scapegoat. So it doesn't necessarily take these extremist groups, but the extremist groups are working hand in hand with the State of Israel and the Zionist movement. And we saw, in the VT, Tommy Robinson, one of the most notorious anti-Muslim extremists on, he's done these high-profile visits to occupied territory along with Israeli soldiers. There was a very famous photo that he tweeted out of him standing with an Israeli rifle on an Israeli tank in the occupied Golan Heights of Syria.
Yes, I remember.
So these connections are ongoing and intimate.
We will come back to you, David, to go into a bit more depth into the nitty-gritty of these stories that we're covering. But we have a very interesting report to bring on next, which takes us over to Latifa Abu Shakra. She tried to pay a visit to the London-based director of the UK Friends of the City of David, Daniel Peters. Latifa wanted to see how he would justify his involvement in ethnic cleansing.
David are instrumental in the cleansing of Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. Yet most people in the UK have no idea that a branch exists here. Despite the funding thrust into David, their directors have received generally very little scrutiny. We decided to pay a visit to the London home of the only UK-based director of the organisation. On a sunny winter's day, we tried to talk to Daniel Peters. So despite the cleaner informing us that the family were home, they did not open the door, despite several attempts. It's clear to see that they had cameras placed around the premises, so security is an issue for them. What are they trying to hide?
Well, there you have it. So Latifa doing her absolute best to confront people involved in this practice. David, I'm going to come to you on this. What did you make of that? And perhaps you could just elaborate a little bit more on if there are any other directors, any other key figures which should be known to the audience.
Well, most of the directors in the UK branch are based in Al-Quds, in Palestine. This is the only one who's based in the sense of living in the UK. There is one other director who has the registered address here, but it appears also to live in 48 Palestine. So this is an organisation essentially run from abroad, but with one director here who's an actuary who has been involved from very early on in this organisation, and has otherwise very low profile. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? There's an organisation here spending lots of money, raising funds to engage in activities which are, on the face of it, in breach of international law. The wider question here is the extent to which this should be allowed to continue. I mean, this is a guy whose house is not under threat. He's been visited by a journalist. He's not been asked to leave his house, to give his house to a Palestinian, which in some ways would be a fair thing to do, given that he is personally involved in depriving particular Palestinian families of their homes as we speak. But there's no public debate about this, and perhaps there should be. And I suppose this is one of the things which is interesting about this whole issue, is that this goes on under the radar, with nobody really seeing or paying attention to it. And perhaps that's something which is about to change.
I think it is interesting to note that in past episodes, again, we've tried to get in contact with organisations which push a kind of Israeli line in the UK education system. And again, they're just hard to get in touch with, these organisations, these individuals that do this type of work. They just don't seem to have numbers, don't seem to be at their offices, don't seem to answer the door, as was this case. Asa, I'm going to bring you back in. Perhaps you could put forward the case for the boycott of these organisations, why it's so important that we do push this initiative. And again, why it's important to... for us to highlight what they're up to, identify who's responsible, and then, of course, that's when the boycott action can come into play.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that none of these organisations, Israel lobby organisations, who are directly involved in ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, for example, seem to want to show their faces at all, because they like to do things behind closed doors. I mean, I find it fascinating because... ostensibly, they have all the support they could possibly ever get. You know, the British government endorses this stuff, despite, you know, public-facing statements from British ministers about, oh, we're deeply concerned about settlements and things and the human rights situation in the West Bank. They say these sort of meaningless statements. Despite those kind of statements, in actual fact, the British government is deeply involved and deeply complicit in this kind of ethnic cleansing. And, it allows not only these kind of organisations to carry out their fundraising activities in this country, but also they support Israel at the highest level, at diplomatic level, at the level of allowing arms exports to Israel, and of the tax deductible donations to these charities, the tax exempt status these organisations often have. It does make the BDS movement important, because the BDS movement is a way that people on the popular level can put pressure on Israel and can... our government is not going to act. You know, thoughts and concerns are going to do nothing. And they're just a way to distract attention from the British government's involvement in these crimes. So BDS puts Israel on the defensive, and it leads to a... It means there's a wider popular pressure against Israel to, there's a cost for Israel to, if it continues these crimes, that we can put pressure on Israel. And this is why, the British government has been, for several years now, has been, threatening to outlaw BDS, quote unquote. Well, they keep saying they're going to do that, but then they don't actually do it. Because in practice, how can you outlaw BDS? You can't really. You can't stop someone...
It's like thought policing, isn't it?
And you can't stop someone not buying something. it's kind of a logical impossibility. There is measures they can take, to chill and kind of repress public campaigning. I think ultimately those kind of measures are not going to be successful. And BDS has really gone from strength to strength in that regard. So, yeah.
For sure. Now, David, I want to come back to you, because possibly one of the most important questions of this show is related to the fact that we heard earlier on in the episode Joyce Annaleigh, a Conservative Foreign Office minister, describe the organisation, referring back to Bianca's report, as carrying out radical settler activities under the guise of tourism. So perhaps you could go into what you think of that. And the fact is that it's now surely a question for the UK Charity Commission, isn't it? I mean, are these guys breaking the law?
Well, I mean, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because to be a charity, you have to show public benefit. And even a Conservative Foreign Office minister is saying, it looks like there's not a public benefit here, that actually this is a disguise. This is not about archaeological digs and lovely parts of ancient Al-Quds or Jerusalem. This is about explorations and demolitions to make way for Jewish settlers. And it's, if even Conservative ministers believe this is to be the case, then it's quite clear there's a disconnect between what the activities are and what they have said they are to give themselves charitable status. So, the next question, of course, is, well, what is the Charity Commission doing about this? And I would urge people who are able to do so to write to the Charity Commission to raise those questions, to say, this is an organisation which is clearly engaging in activity which is illegal under international law, and it should not be given charitable status. And that, hopefully, is the thing which can start to open up the space for a whole series of other organisations, including very mainstream Zionist organisations like, for example, the Jewish National Fund, which is engaged in ethnic cleansing and settlement in the occupied territories in the same way as the City of David people are, but has much more money, has millions of pounds every year going into effectively illegal operations. So I think that this is really the next front for BDS, is to close down all these charities. We start with one and then we close them all. And that's really what we have to do in order to defeat Zionism. We have to defeat the means by which it sustains itself, which includes the money which comes from this country.
And I know that is a front which is already being used by pro-Israel groups. They are going after Muslim charities, yeah, and things like that, trying to brand them as extremists for what? Putting money into Gaza to try and help civilians there and things like that. We are approaching the end of the show, gentlemen, so unfortunately I'll have to stop it there. But I'm sure we'll have you both back on very, very soon in the near future, especially you, David. But that is unfortunately all the time we have for this edition of the show. But thank you for tuning in. And don't worry, we'll be back next time for more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. It's goodbye for now.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are presently taking inspiration from the sermon number 168, which Imam Ali alayhi salam gave at the start of the Battle of Siffin. And in this sermon, he kind of shows us the role of the leader in guiding the community, in taking them out, in guiding the community, in removing them from the darkness of confusion and the darkness of trials and tribulations where a believer is not able to understand or discern the true path. And here, Imam Ali alayhi salam, especially in the Battle of Siffin, he talks about the fact that now the time has come when your enemy is one who wears the clothes that you wear. If you look at yourself, you look at him, you will not see a difference between you and him, because your acts of worship will be the same. The slogans you give are the same. The apparent words and the way you carry yourself would be the same. So all of these things are like that. So you need to be really, really careful. This was there also at the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, whereby Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says in one of the narrations, he said, all of us had a kadhab yakdhibu alayna. We had a person who used to belie us, all of the Ahlul Bayt, but they would belie us in a tricky way, hiding behind the scenes. And this is the most dangerous form, and we need to be very careful about this type of enemy.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary